Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a webinar, After Drummond, What's Next in the Debate Over Religious Charter Schools, featuring Professor John Meeser and Rachel Lazar. Our moderator for today's discussion is Professor Michael Moreland. Professor Moreland is a University Professor of Law and Religion at Villanova University and Chair of the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Professor Moreland, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco, and thank you, as always, to the Federal Society for sponsoring these interesting and enriching programs about current legal topics. I'll introduce the topic very briefly and then introduce our panelists, and then we'll start our conversation. I'll leave time at the end, as Marco said, for some questions from the audience that you can put in the bottom of the Zoom window. In Oklahoma's statewide charter school board versus Drummond, the U.S. Supreme Court took up the question of whether the operation of charter schools by religious entities was constitutionally permissible or perhaps even required. The court deadlocked 4-4, leaving in place a ruling by the Oklahoma Supreme Court that the religious charter school, St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School, violated the Establishment Clause. This forum will take up the questions left unanswered in Drummond and what the next phase of the debate over religious charter schools will look like, including whether charter schools should be considered state actors and whether the Free Exercise Clause prevents a state from prohibiting religious operators from forming charter schools. And to discuss this topic, we have two outstanding panelists. Again, I will introduce them briefly. You can learn more about them and their backgrounds at the Federal Society website. Rachel Lazar is the president and the CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And John Meeser is associate clinical professor and director of the Lindsay and Matt Moron Religious Liberty Clinic at the Notre Dame Law School. Thank you both for participating in this program. First, we've done some programs on this topic before, including before and after the oral argument in the case. But John, I thought I would start with you. For those who maybe are new to this issue, what was this case about? How did it get teed up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court? And what were the primary issues?
Sure, of course. And also echo Michael's thanks to Marco and the Federal Society for inviting me for hosting this webinar, but the series in general, I think is terrific. And Michael, thank you for coordinating all this. So what is this case about? I think at the most abstract, this case is about how should courts draw the line between what is the government's to control and what is private? What is private conduct that is entitled to certain rights and privileges, including obviously those under the First Amendment. So that distilled in our question is what is a charter school in Oklahoma, right? Like, is that a government run thing that the government gets to control, or is it more of a privately operated thing that is regulated by the government, that interacts with the government, but that is entitled to certain rights under the First Amendment? And as I think will become clear in our discussion, I'll explain more in just a second. As the case made its way to the Supreme Court, one thing that became interesting, I think maybe to many observers, is that the parties, be the school, St. Isidore, the state board that approved it, I'll discuss in a moment, and the opposition party, the Attorney General of Oklahoma, didn't really disagree on a lot of fundamental First Amendment principles, which is to say they all effectively agree that if this school was essentially private, if its operation was essentially private, that is entitled to certain rights to participate in a charter school program. And if it's effectively government, then it wasn't. So how did we get here? So the school, St. Isidore Seville Catholic Virtual School from Oklahoma, was a project that was started by the two Catholic dioceses in Oklahoma. So the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, the Diocese of Tulsa, and it grew out of their experience, which was, I think, familiar across the country to educators, their experience during COVID with online virtual education. And as they went online, sort of by necessity during the height of COVID, they also realized that, hey, this is an interesting, this virtual education is an interesting and effective way to reach communities that the many brick and mortar Catholic schools in Oklahoma don't presently reach. It's a very rural state. So you just can't physically have Catholic schools or maybe other types of private schools close to everyone in the state. And they found that it's actually, even aside from proximity, there are certain students who flourished, who did well in a virtual setting. Certain learning needs were actually well addressed in virtual settings. So they wanted to do this full time, and they started thinking, how could they do that? And so it happened, and they knew that Oklahoma had a virtual charter school program. And that program allows private organizations to apply to a state chartering board to start a new virtual charter school. So these are all online charter schools. They're all statewide. They all have to admit all children. But you effectively, the operator, you pitch the state on what kind of school you want to run, what kind of education you're going to provide, and why that's an important thing the state should get behind. And there's STEM ones. There's sort of foreign language immersion schools, theater art schools. There's all sorts of different charter schools in Oklahoma. But Oklahoma, like every other state, which I think is over 40 that have charter schools, define charter schools as public schools. And one consequence of that definition is they also say charter schools cannot be religious. They can't be religiously affiliated, and they can't teach religious curriculum. So you would think it was a non-starter for the diocese, but they were aware of this line of cases, which ultimately culminated in Carson versus Macon, where the Supreme Court said, look, states don't have to subsidize private education through things like vouchers, tuition reimbursements, things like that. But if they do, the Supreme Court said, they can't discriminate against schools that are religious. You can't offer a voucher to attend a secular private school, but not to attend a Jewish day school or a Catholic private school. And so given the way that Oklahoma's program was structured, they thought, well, you know, these are defined, these are called in the law public schools, but they really look private. They're organized by private entities. They get to design their own curriculum, these sorts of things. So why doesn't that rule apply to us? Through a sort of like process that is not worth getting into the details of, I suppose, the then Attorney General of Oklahoma, John O'Connor, actually wrote an opinion agreeing with the school and telling the virtual charter board, yeah, if this school applies, you should not enforce our non-religious affiliation requirement, because that would be unconstitutional. So you have to let them apply. And if it's a good application, if the school is going to be good, you can't deny it just because it's religious. His successor then took office and actually disagreed. Long story short, the school was approved in the summer of 2023. And then thereafter entered into a contract with the sponsoring state board that would provide the state funds to operate. And it would have then started in the fall of 24, but then two lawsuits were filed, one by a group of parents and some interest groups, actually represented by, among others, Rachel's organization. And they brought a host of claims under Oklahoma law primarily. And then also the Oklahoma Attorney General, which sort of became the centerpiece of the litigation, filed a suit, an action directly in the Oklahoma Supreme Court to say, hey, this violates our constitution. It violates the federal constitution. These are public schools and they can't be religious. And ultimately, the Oklahoma Supreme Court agreed on two different theories. They said both these schools are functionally government entities. They said the Supreme Court of Oklahoma said they're sort of formed by the government. They're obviously oversight provided by the government, and they're defined as public. And said even if they weren't, even if these are really private entities, they're so heavily regulated, they're they have to answer to the government in so many different ways. They behave in certain aspects like other government-run schools, that therefore, for the purposes of the Constitution, the government is the state action doctrine. The government is the true actor here. And so therefore there are no private First Amendment rights at issue. my clinic, among others, represented the school. So we and also the state approving board both separately petitioned the Supreme Court. Obviously, the court, as Michael says, took up these questions about, well, what is this school really? Is this really a private school? Is this really a public school? Is it really right that Oklahoma can keep religious actors out of this program? Took up those questions, but as I think we probably all know, did not answer those questions. Justice Barrett had recused herself, and the court ultimately divided 4-4. Teeing up our topic for the day, what are the questions left unanswered? All of them, I guess, is the answer to your question. All of the questions are left unanswered. And Michael, I don't know if you want me to highlight one or two of those questions now or wait.
Maybe we'll turn over to Rachel for a bit. To John's given us kind of the background of the topic and how the case got up to the U.S. Supreme Court and what the issues were. I'm wondering what I suspect you have a different view of, at least what the, if not what the main questions were, at least how those questions should have been answered. So maybe you could say how you saw the case from the perspective of your organization, and then we'll go on to what those unanswered questions are.
Thanks, Michael, John, Federalist Society, Marco. I appreciate dialogues across differences. I think that's what America needs. For us, we did bring our own case. John referred to that. And we represented a group of families, pastors, and public school advocates. And that included Christian clergy and included Catholic families, which I just wanted to state here since we're talking about a Catholic school. And for our plaintiffs, really, this is a case that is about America's promise of religious freedom. And it's sort of religious freedom at its most fundamental level, because it's a case about whether taxpayers can be forced to fund a religion that isn't their own. And even beyond a religion, right, religious education, which I think we'd all agree is in many ways sort of the heart of religion, because it sustains it. And so back to sort of the court, you know, the Oklahoma State Supreme Court that ruled in Republican Attorney General Drummond's case. So we brought our own case. Republican Attorney General Drummond, the Attorney General of Oklahoma, brought his case. That's the case that went to the Supreme Court. But the Oklahoma State Supreme Court was where Republican Attorney General Drummond brought his case. And they ruled in a way that I think was very sort of great, I suppose, which is that they did find, and John, you referenced this, that St. Isidore Charter School is a government entity and a state actor. And, you know, for a gazillion reasons, you know, and you started to name them, John. I mean, the fact that it's created by the state, the fact that it's subject to dissolution by the state, the fact that it has to follow state standards, the fact that it has to be open to all, that it's fulfilling a state function of a constitutional requirement of providing public education that's open to all, et cetera, et cetera. And what the court found was that St. Isidore of Seville Charter School violates the federal and Oklahoma state constitutional promise of religious freedom, and also promise that public schools can't be religious, as well as the Oklahoma charter school law that John also referenced, that says that charter schools are public schools and can't be religious. And St. Isidore, and I don't think anyone's contesting this, right? But just to state the obvious, is a Catholic school. You know, its goal is to, quote, create, establish, and operate the school as a Catholic school. It will be, according to its own application for approval, a place of evangelization that participates in the evangelizing mission of the church, et cetera, et cetera. And so the idea here is that since St. Isidore Charter School is a government entity and a state actor, tax dollars going to a school that's a state actor that's not open to all students violates our Constitution. So the bottom line here for us is we think this is a great decision. And it's a great decision because it protects religious freedom for taxpayers. That is very basic in this country, right? Thomas Jefferson said that it's sinful and tyrannical to require a man to fund a religion that's not his own. Like, we feel like we're in the realm of that level of basics here. Also, public schools are funded with public dollars and they should be open to all, which St. Isidore obviously isn't. And let me just make this one final point. Religious education should be left to families and clergy, and that is best for religion, right? It means that religion isn't going to be subject to government interference. That's a dangerous game for religion to play. And that's also the system where public schools are open to all and secular, and religious education is what's taking place with families and our Sunday schools and houses of worship. That is the wisdom of church-state separation in our country.
Thank you, Rachel. Well, you can see we have a difference of opinion here about the Oklahoma Supreme Court opinion that was affirmed by an equally divided U.S. Supreme Court. Rachel says it was great. I suspect John thinks it wasn't so great. but John, maybe to circle back. So now that that decision has been is still on the books, what are, to take our panel's topic question, what are the next questions then? Where does this whole issue go next?
Yeah, I'm going to focus first, Michael, on the question of charter schools, which obviously we're all talking about. I think it might be useful later to step back a bit and broaden. I think the questions lying underneath the specific charter school issue in this case, and I guess and potentially others down the road, is reflective of a deeper issue about dividing or drawing the line between the government and the private sphere. But so the questions in this case, or what are the next questions, are I think essentially right. They're the questions that are in this case, and I think, like, as in all things, a lot of what Rachel was just saying, right, is at the most sort of abstract level of course true, right? Like, government run schools, public schools, can't teach religion. They can't force, you can't require a child to go to a school where he'll be taught a religion that his parents didn't choose. The government can't run parochial schools, right? Things like that. But, as always, the devil's in the details, right? So the real, I think, heart of this case is, what do we do with the fact that in Oklahoma or in other states, these schools are called public schools, right? So, like, any person on the street, you say public school, I think we're all going to have the same reaction. You think government school, your mind goes to government school, and you think, well, of course a public school can't be religious. And again, I think all sides agree with that basic point, that government run schools, the government creates and operates, can't be religious. But the Supreme has been clear for decades that just because you call something a label doesn't make it so, right? Just because you call something public doesn't mean that thing is public broadcaster, things like this. Like, there's been a series of cases, public utilities, where they have the word public, but they're actually effectively private. And so what does the doctrine ask us to look at? It asks us to look at not just saying that the government is responsible for this, but actually asking, like, where's the evidence of that? So here, just to take our case as an example, but this will be what's relevant elsewhere. St. Isidore is a privately formed corporation that existed prior to, it applied as a privately formed corporation. It was formed by the bishops of Oklahoma. It is a private nonprofit corporation, just as every other private nonprofit corporation in Oklahoma is. The state didn't create it. It came up, it designed its Catholic curriculum. Obviously, state didn't tell it to do that. There were no state entities involved. And importantly, and this is a huge dividing line in the case law, between some corporations like Amtrak that are effectively public and those that aren't. The ones that are public have a governing board that's controlled by public officials, right? St. Isidore doesn't have a single publicly appointed official on its board. The teachers at charter schools in Oklahoma are not public employees. They don't have to have Oklahoma teaching certificates like the public schools do. So they are overseen and regulated, and there's certain, like, curricular requirements and things that have to follow. But that's just true when the government gets involved in funding anything. Like, my kids go to a parochial school in Indiana, which has a pretty robust voucher program. If you could look up the Indiana rules for voucher participating schools, they have all sorts of curricular requirements. Do teach this about Indiana history. Do teach this about U.S. history. But no one would say that St. Pius X Catholic Church, where my kids go to school, is a government entity because of that, right? And so what the questions, what are the sort of central questions here is, I think we all agree on which side of the line, why the line matters. But the questions that really matter are, hey, when a state comes in and regulates something or calls something its own or is involved in some way in funding it, right? how much of each of those things makes it in fact the government. And just one last thing for this I'll end on is I think Rachel like knows this. We talked about this a little bit when we were planning the call. Like I understand her concern with taxpayer dollars going to fund religious education or going to religious activity. I think there's actually a very long history of that throughout our whole, in the last 2.5 centuries of our country's history and before. But I guess more to the point, that's not a question presented by this case. I mean, the court has made clear that there is no Establishment Clause concern in things like voucher programs and things like that with money going to taxpayers' money, excuse me, going to religious education. Like, as long as everyone's on an equal playing field, it's being doled out in a neutral way and everyone's secular and religious are participating, then that's okay.
Thank you, John. Rachel, over to you. Maybe you could say a bit about why you do think charter schools, and obviously some of this depends on each state's particular provisions, which we don't have the time to get into in much detail, but why you think that charter schools are public schools and thereby are subject to the limitations of the Establishment Clause. And maybe a little bit, if you'd like to take up John's last point about why you think that even if Zelman cases like that about vouchers are right, or even if you don't think they're right, they're now 25 years old, but why this was, in your view, a bridge too far.
Okay. There's a lot in that. So let me try and break it down. So I guess I'll start by saying, fine, let's even go past this sort of definition in the charter school law, John, you know, that charter schools are public schools. So then we look at the fact that charter schools have numerous other characteristics that are in common with traditional public schools. And that confirms that they're government entities. They have to be open to all. They can't charge tuition or fees. They must provide academic programs that are aligned with state standards. They receive state funding according to the same formulas that apply to traditional public schools. They have to comply with the same rules that govern traditional public schools on the school year length and on transportation and student testing, et cetera, et cetera. I also want to talk to the point about sort of whether they'd exist or not without the government, because St. Isidore is very free to open its doors tomorrow and join the 30 other Catholic schools in Oklahoma. And, you know, AU would not go do that. Great. That's not in our terrain, you know, of Americans United, right? But the only reason that St. Isidore exists as a charter school is because the government brought it into existence. And similarly, it's subject to dissolution by the government. Let me make one more point, because John was talking about governance. When St. Isidore was approved as a charter school, its board members became public officials by state law. So it is, in fact, also governed by the state. So, I mean, now I'm talking very technically, and we can talk about what the problems are here. And there are so many problems with having sort of state governing of religion for religion, you know, very dangerous. I've worked for the Religious Action Center of Reformed Judaism for many years, and I'm a proud Jew, and I certainly wouldn't want that to happen to Jewish schools, right? But we can save that topic. You asked also about private school vouchers and, you know, Espinoza and Carson. And we would really strongly distinguish those cases from here, because those cases are about indirect and partial funding, right, that goes through parents. And private school vouchers is a whole other topic, and we can take that up separately, and the problems with it and the way, you know, the test scores aren't good, and it helps families that already can afford private schools, and some, and the roots of it and resistance to Brown versus Board of Education, et cetera, et cetera. But we can come back to that, Michael, if you want. But really, like, the distinction here is we're talking about direct and full taxpayer funding of religion. And that's a very different situation. It would be a sea change. It would be a sea change for our democracy to have religious public schools. And it's dangerous for taxpayers' religious freedom. And once again, I just want to go back to how dangerous it is for religious schools, because no one wants the government to be overseeing what religious schools' curricula should or shouldn't be. That's not a good situation for religion.
John, back over to you, maybe to respond, if you like, to some of Rachel's comments, and choose any of them that you wish. But one in particular that I know was picked up on in the brief by Greg Garr and the on the side of the Attorney General of Oklahoma, that the board or that the entity somehow only came into existence by virtue of Oklahoma state action, and that it sort of changed the character of it into more of a government actor or a government entity by virtue of that.
Yeah, so I can start there, Michael. I mean, this is quite in the weeds, so I'll try not to dwell on it too long. But you're right. So at the Supreme Court, I mentioned at the Oklahoma Supreme Court, there were kind of two avenues of thought at the Oklahoma Supreme Court's decision, the majority's decision, as to why an Oklahoma charter school is a state actor. It was one, it is a government entity. It became like the thing itself is part of the government, as opposed to second, well, maybe if the school even isn't part of the government, it's so entwined or regulated by it that it's still subject to state actor analysis. At the U.S. Supreme Court level, it was really just the former argument that they focused on. And like you say, it was this idea. So like no one can deny what I just said a minute ago, that the school, when it applied, right, it was a privately formed nonprofit organization. The argument from the other side went that yes, but, and I think this is kind of what Rachel was just getting at, that but when you enter this chartering process, right, and this process of application and approval and contracting and all that, the result of that process was to spin off a new entity, so to speak, a charter school. And that charter school, whatever the private organization that applied was, that charter school is a specifically governmental entity, I think is the essence of the idea. The problem is it feels a little like alchemy. It's a little existential, right? And you have to step back and say, well, what is a corporation? What is any I don't mean like a capital C corporation, but any sort of corporate group. What is it? It's just an association of people, right, doing something. And so then to define what kind of entity any given entity is, you have to look at who are the people that formed and ran it. And again, this is all in the briefing of the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. If you look at those cases like the Amtrak case and others where the Supreme Court has found a corporation nonetheless to be public, it's because the corporate charter, I mean, sorry, not charter, I'll address the word of charter in a second, but the corporate sort of like formation documents were done by the government, or the government was involved in it and designing it. But more explicitly, the government has populated the controlling board, right? Like there are presidential appointees, there are congressional appointees, there are things like that. So then, and then the only thing that really left is this idea, well, it's chartered, right? It's a publicly chartered school, but all private corporations, the Supreme Court has pointed this out, nearly all hold a charter given by a state government. So the fact that the government involves itself and makes you come through the government to form an entity in some way or another doesn't make that the entity you're forming the government's. I'm going to pivot to something broader, if that's okay, Michael. And on the last point about, I think Rachel mentioned that the government. So in our case, it was the exact same bylaws, same governance documents, same board, like literal same human beings on the board from the original incorporation to post chartering process. So that nothing new came into formation. It was the exact same thing. And there is nothing in the law that establishes that these people, like the Chancellor of the Archdiocese of Oklahoma, became a government official. That's just not in the law. But aside from all that, like, why does this matter, right? Because you could say, I think a lot of the tone of what Rachel's getting at is, you know, there's other things you can do, right? And maybe choosing to go through this chartering route, maybe that's actually, I think this could be a fair fight, a debate that could be had among policy experts or religious educators, which is it better or worse to go through this route versus another? But that's not, you know, those choices about what's better for the Catholic schools in Oklahoma or any other state is made to those Catholic educators who run those schools. And they, you know, they get to make those choices just like all other secular private educators get to make them, whether the government conditions are sort of worth, you know, whether that makes it more preferable to do something else or not. That's kind of a policy choice for them to make. But the thing that I think really matters is this doesn't just take one option off the table. This is representative of a move that governments try a lot. And if it's successful, we'll cut religious groups out of a lot of sectors of activity. And I'll just give one example, which I think Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, the case a few years back about Catholic social services in Philadelphia participating in the foster care system, something they'd done for centuries. The exact same arguments that are being made here were made there. And actually the Fulton oral argument really focuses on this. Well, this is the government's program. It's the government's contract. Can't they decide who's in and who's out? Can't they make foster care service providers agree to certain non-discrimination provisions in that case about same-sex couples? And the same argument that Rachel just made would apply there. Catholic social services in Philadelphia can do a lot of things, but if it chooses to participate in the state's foster care system, if it wants to be a foster care certifier, well, that's a thing, just like being a charter school. What is a charter school? A charter school is a school that participates in a state charter program. So to tell the organizers they can do a lot of different types of schools, but you can't do this kind of school, is very similar to telling Catholic Social Services in Philadelphia, you can do a lot of stuff for families and kids and adoption, but if you want to be a state foster care certifier, that's a state-run thing and you're now part of us. That argument didn't fly in Fulton. And if it were to be given legs here, it could be applied across a lot of different areas where the state really relies on needs, religious organizations to provide like critical services like shelter and all sorts of other things.
Rachel, feel free to respond in.
I agree, John, like we could kind of go endlessly in the weeds at sort of the details, but I think the bottom line is, was there substantial government control? Is there substantial government control here? And the answer is absolutely. Also, Fulton, just to go lawyerly for a minute, Fulton was a very limited decision based on, you know, this funkiness in the contract and this discretionary exemption stuff. And it actually didn't even consider if foster care agencies are state actors. So I just did want to distinguish it in that way. Back to you, Michael.
We already have some questions. So I'll maybe ask one round of another question that I mentioned to the panelists when we were preparing for this, and then we'll look to some audience questions. And it's this: given that we're now talking about what's next in this debate about religious charter schools, John, and I'll sort of ask the inverse of the question to each of you, John, would there be ways in which a state, if it really wanted to prevent the operation of charter schools by religious entities, could change or amend or look at its charter school laws in such a way that the St. Isidore option would be foreclosed? And then I'll ask the question, would there be ways if a state wanted to invite religious participants into its charter school program that it could do so in such a way that while you might not like it, you would have to concede that the constitutional doctrine in this area leans that direction. So, John, to you.
Yeah, I think as our conversation's unpacked and as like the briefing written arguments in the case make clear, the way a state, if state wants there to be a system of schools to which religious educators don't get to apply or participate, the only way it can do that is if those schools are government schools, right? Like the whole point of Carson and the whole line of Trinity Lutheran cases is that a state need not subsidize private education. Like that's a policy choice. But if it does subsidize private education, it can't kick out the religious. So how do they design a charter program that would allow a state who does not want there to be religious charter schools into the program? They have to do the work themselves. Those have to be government-run schools. So like these touch points we've been identifying, creation, control, I don't mean control by regulation. Everything in the country is regulated. Boeing is regulated as much as you could be. No one thinks Boeing is the U.S. government. But control, like formal control on the school. Is it run by a public school district, like a school board of elected individuals? Curricular design. So I don't mean just like, again, like the parochial schools that my kids attend in Indiana. I don't mean just you have to teach these 17 subjects. It's more than 17. And you have to do it for this many days a year and things like that. But I mean, the whole point of a charter program is to design schools that will look different from each other. And that's great. But if the state wants a program like that, it's going to have to come up with, you know, the designs itself. So if I were a state who wanted to have something like a charter program that allows me to regulate out, I suppose, keep out religious schools, it would have to be, the schools are need to be like really formally formed and controlled by public officials. And I think there's going to have to be really close attention to just how much are they designing and controlling the day-to-day operations of the school beyond the simple idea of regulating, right? Which we see a lot of.
Rachel.
Well, I don't love the question.
But well, I don't want them to kick out of religious schools either.
I guess what I would say is, look, we already have this line of cases that started with Zelman in 2002. And frankly, we don't like them, but that allow government dollars to go through, to pass through parents indirectly and to fund religious education partially. And anything that goes beyond that just so clearly runs afoul of the Constitution. And I would just also sort of back out of it a little bit and just say, you know, religious education is doing well. It's thriving. And what will guarantee that it continues to thrive is if it stays separate from becoming too closely related to the government. I mean, look, we've seen with this administration, the way when the government sort of controls the purse strings, it can control the agenda. You know, some people applaud that and, you know, some people don't. But I think the point is, like, with real government involvement and support, strings are attached and they should be attached. And that is not a good thing for religious schools. So I would say, let, you know, the whatever they are, over 100 religious schools, 30 Catholic schools in Oklahoma continue to thrive. Let St. Isidore become a 31 or whatever. But it's just not, it's running afoul of our Constitution to allow a charter school with the way charter schools function to be religious.
All right. Well, I said we would get to some audience questions. And again, if you have some, put them in the Q&A at the bottom of the Zoom window. There's a couple here that maybe I'll try to assimilate together. One question is, someone asked, does St. Isidore only accept Catholic children or are non-Catholics allowed to enter? In Chicago, the Catholic schools especially do not require being Catholic. Someone else asked, was admission to St. Isidore limited to Catholics or open to others? John, you probably know the answer to that question.
Yeah, this goes hand in hand with the sort of conditions point that Rachel just ended on. And the thing I was saying earlier where, yeah, conditions are going to be attached to funding, and it's up to individual private educators to figure out what's best way forward for them. So for this particular question, yeah, St. Isidore is no more. But were it to have opened, yes, it was explicit throughout in the application and in the litigation. It was open lottery enrollment. So right. So I think one of the commenters pointed out that when Chicago, the schools they're familiar with have some sort of preference or priority for Catholic students. I think that's also true in Oklahoma's other private, parochial schools. But this is a different model, right? They went in with open eyes and they said, if we're going to do this, it's going to have to look a little bit different than, around, at least around some aspects, than our other schools might. And one of those was they were not going to give any preference to Catholic schools, students, because they understood that condition applied and it made sense in the program. And it was one that they were happy to take on. I understand some schools might not make that choice. And this came up at oral argument. And this is a big, big open question, but it's not just in ours, but in the Carson et al. Cases. So you have to let these groups into the programs. What conditions can be attached, conditions that might be religiously onerous. And that's just this whole other area of law about the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. And our case actually didn't really present that as came out at argument because the school had agreed to comply with that.
Ooh, can I come into this?
Yes.
Go ahead. I remember, just when I was first learning about the case, And so I was sort of wondering about this very question. And so I went on to the St. Isidore website to sort of see what they say, you know, because the requirement is that charter schools be open to all, and sort of how are they going to deal with that? And you can apply if you're not Catholic. That is true. But what the website said is basically their website, that you have to comply with their policies and procedures and their morality code, which is in keeping with the Catholic Church. So, I mean, This is a Catholic school. So to me, it's pretty empty to say, you know, everyone's welcome here, but, you know, you as a Jewish family have to be comfortable with your kids potentially being taught that when everybody dies, you know, your kids won't be in good shape, or, you know, I mean, it doesn't feel very real to me.
I mean, I don't think that there's any point in litigating what a hypothetical school would or wouldn't have done that's never going to open. But okay, this is not a fair representation of the school's plan. Kids could not only apply but enroll. Like admission was open to anyone and not denied on any basis whatsoever to do with religion or anything else. And then the fact that all children were required to abide by the standards of conduct is true across all Oklahoma charter schools. Now, Oklahoma doesn't have to design it this way, but I'll just give you a couple examples. Like there is, I forget which tribe, there's a handful of tribal charter schools in Oklahoma, one of which in their disciplinary policies says is an operating charter school in Oklahoma. And in their disciplinary policies, it says that student conduct will be handled through spiritual practices. They invoke before opening the student conduct meeting, they invoke spiritual guidance from the tribal, in accordance with the tribal practices. There are others that have peacemaking processes, and there's one that's in the Hillsdale model. It's a very strict classical curriculum and disciplinary model where it accepts sort of like no broaches of decorum or something like that. So the disciplinary policies in all of these schools look very different from each other. And I fully agree that some children or some families would find themselves able to fit within some of these disciplinary expectations or these rules expectations, and some wouldn't. But that's very, very different from saying you're not allowed in the school, you're not welcome here. And it's just not true that St. Isidore wouldn't have welcomed the kids of any faith or not. But again, like it's all hypothetical. Yeah. Like the school's not even going to open.
It's hypothetical, but we saw their application. And their application, and I just found it, right? And I'm quoting, says that admission assumes the student and family willingness to adhere with respect to the beliefs, expectations, policies, and procedures of the school. So, you know, to say you can apply from all belief systems, but you're expected, if we admit you, to adhere to our beliefs, that's not very sincere.
I mean, it's one word in a several hundred page application that, as when it was spelled out in the school's policies, it was very clear students didn't have to believe in the Catholic faith. They could even, there's only a couple annual masses. Students were allowed to seek exemptions not to attend the mass if it didn't accord with their faith. So it's just, I understand that you can pick a sentence here or there out of an application, but when put into practice, there's no evidence that the school wouldn't ever have agreed to the things they said in litigation repeatedly. Of course, all kids are welcome. But again, I think we should step back. Like this broader question about what conditions can be applied, whether they be on admissions or discipline or anything else, and how they could be applied. This is a huge question left in the doctrine. But I want to emphasize, it's not a unique question to this charter school world. Like right now in Maine, they're litigating the follow-on from Carson versus Macon, where Maine lost in Carson versus Macon. They can no longer kick out schools that teach in a religious way. They've now attached new conditions to their participation in that same program, and is presently being litigated about whether those conditions effectively foreclose religious schools from participating in the program and are therefore unconstitutional as well. This is a question in a lot of different areas that the court is going to have to take up probably relatively soon.
But sorry, just one last thing, Michael, I promise. Just that this is what we're doing. I mean, I don't want to gloss over, though, this idea that Catholicism sort of permeates the school, or that it's not really a place for all, is sort of misrepresented in that one sentence that I said, because I actually think that doesn't do justice to the Catholic school. I mean, and I just want to point out, so, you know, another part of the application says, the tradition and teaching of the Catholic Church and the virtue of Christian living will permeate the school day and will be expressed through worship, prayer, religion classes, and the general climate of the school. And that's a good thing. And that's a good thing, as it should in a Catholic school. Like, if I'm a parent, you know, I sent my kids to Jewish like preschool because I wanted them to learn our values and everything. And that's great. Like, this is exactly what I mean, that like in defending it as a government sort of run government, you know, subject to a lot of government things, school, John, I'm hearing you have to almost like back down on its Catholicism. And that's a good thing for the school.
No, no one would suggest the school be anything, but the school is very open. I think very forthcoming. I think it does not do justice to the Catholic tradition and the Catholic faith and Catholic education to suggest that a school where Catholicism permeates is a school where those who are not Catholic are not welcome. That's just not true. It hasn't been true across centuries. We could go through example after example of people who have come to and benefited from and are deeply thankful for the opportunity to receive a Catholic education, who are not themselves Catholic, who did not become Catholic, and who did not die Catholics. So again, I don't really think it's the point of what we're doing here, but the school, of course, would have been open to all students. And the fact that Catholicism would permeate the classroom does not change that answer to that.
Maybe let me jump in with a question here that maybe Rachel, you could take a stab at, because I think you might have something to say about it. So the question says, I think the more difficult establishment question relates to the choice of whether to approve a charter application. I don't think it's possible to create a sufficiently comprehensive matrix that says if an applicant checks all these boxes, then the authorizer will approve, which is to say some degree of judgment enters in. If that's true, what happens when an authorizer approves an application from one church but not another? Without the intervening actor that Zelman contemplates, how does an authorizer avoid an establishment problem? Wouldn't the authorizer inevitably put their thumb on the scale in favor of one religion over another? So it's some long question, but I think it kind of tees up the issue there.
That's a softball. I think we're all human beings, and I think that's exactly right. Like, it's hard to imagine, it's almost impossible to imagine that there wouldn't be bias that comes into, let's say there's like a limited number of charter schools that you can approve, or a limited number of dollars that you can divvy out or something. And let's say, you know, I don't know, the Satanic Temple applies, or these, you know, the Church of Flying Spaghetti Monster, or I don't know, you know, and someone applies, and, you know, it's just hard to imagine an individual's bias not coming into play. And that is actually, I think, one of the worst things possible for America right now. That's what I want to say, because I think I hope that everyone on this call, Marco, you too, and everyone listening would agree that we're very divided right now. And that's not a good thing. Like, the level of divisiveness it's actually dangerous right now. Right. And I mean, our founders knew that, you know, the government playing any favorites when it comes to religion is bloody wars, that it really does divide us in very serious ways. You can look even across American history, like the Philadelphia Bible riots, right, where people were killed. I mean, it has continued to show up. And I would argue, and I know it's self-interested, but I am a student of this, and I've spent almost 8 years looking at it every day, that the continuous undermining of the separation of church and state, which is the guarantee of religious freedom, is part of the reason that we are as divided as we are right now. So yes to that question.
John, since it is an important issue as the panel is about, the next stage of all this, does the authorization process inevitably have more of an establishment clause set of concerns to it, as the questioner was implying, than maybe in the Oklahoma case?
Yeah, so I think the authorization process is obviously a government-run process, right? So you get to skip that step, right? And so if the government authorizers are making choices, doling out benefits based on religious preferences, like their own religious preferences, then yeah, I think that's obvious that raise very serious First Amendment concerns. And I take Rachel's point, right, about individual biases, and like, none of us, there's no system one could design right, to safeguard that stuff out of it. But the lesson of Carson et al., you know, whether we prefer it or not, the lesson of Carson et al. Is if you open up a neutral benefits program, by which I mean like anyone can apply. If you open up a benefits program to subsidize private conduct or private entities or whatever else, even if it's application driven, you can't say at the front end, no application from a church will be considered, right? You can't say everyone except the religious can apply. Now, I agree. In evaluating those applications, it needs to be done on a neutrally, on a religiously neutral basis. I also agree that's not always at the margins, maybe going to be easy. But it has to be done on neutral basis about all sorts of other biases that we all know about, right? Like you can't dole out benefits based on someone's biases against a certain race or against a certain ethnicity or against anything else, right? Against a certain sex. Do individuals do that when they're making decisions? Yeah, probably, unfortunately so, but that's just human nature. And you can't at the front end say, we're really afraid of someone doing this in an unconstitutionally discriminatory way. And so the way we'll do it, we'll just embed the unconstitutional discrimination in on the front end. You can't do it that way.
I have a response if you want, or I can wait.
Should we go on to another question maybe?
Yeah, and then you can leave
your comments into the rest. Since they're all sort of a lot of overlapping
issues.
So one question is there anything relatively unique about Oklahoma's system that affects the characterization as public or private? In other words, would the federal establishment clause reasoning of the Oklahoma Supreme Court apply with equal force to other states' systems? Rachel?
A lot of states say that charter schools are public schools explicitly, like Oklahoma. Other state systems are generally similar, is what I would say. And I do have a response to what John said that I'll just quickly bring up, even though I can't quickly figure out how to tie it to what I just said and be smooth about it. So apologies. But I did just want to say that, you know, I think the thing about religion and religious freedom is that there's something really like particular and special about religion in this country, and that our founders were so dedicated to this Enlightenment idea of the importance of freedom of conscience and religious freedom. Like they got, right? Like people are literally willing to die for it. And we see that every day around the world, right? They got how important it was. And so they were dedicated to separating religion from the government in order to protect that freedom of conscience. And what concerns me about, John, like the idea that you were talking about, oh, we can't leave religion out, you know, like is like, to think about that in non-charter public school context, right? Think about that just like in the public, like what you would consider like traditional public school context, right? Like we cannot get to a place in this society where abiding by the Constitution becomes a constitutional violation, where, you know, where like, because you agreed, I think, earlier in the conversation that like public schools should be secular, right? And so like,
yeah, a government run school, of course, yeah,
right. And so that is the concern, that like we are moving too fast towards a place where, you know, treating religion in this special way by separating religion from the state in order to protect religion and religious freedom in and of itself becomes accused of disparaging or discriminating against religion, because really that's backwards and it protects religion and it's part of the DNA of America.
Michael, I don't remember the original question, but I can respond to that part if you want. I want to comment on this theme that's come up for the last few minutes about, you know, religious plural. So like, right. So the answer to all of this is equality and pluralism, right? You know, Justice Breyer, he, during Carson and some other arguments, would bring up this idea that if we allow funding, taxpayer funding, to go to religious education, and obviously taxpayer A might like taxpayer B's education that he sort of like partially funded, and then there's going to be riots and all these things. This is not true. And we've seen, like, you know, since Espinosa, Carson, Trinity, Zelman, it's not as if we're having religious wars in the streets. And relatedly, why? Because one of, I think, the historically proven surest ways to help foster religious harmony and pluralism and the things that Rachel is describing is by letting everyone in equally to participate in the things the government administers. And it cannot be lost that the Bible riots that were referenced in the 19th century grew directly from pleas starting in New York and then spreading it toward the West by Catholic educators that the government-run schools at the time were hostile to Catholic immigrant children. And when they were told they couldn't exempt themselves from particular practices that were hostile to their religion, they said, including reading from the King James Bible, hence the Bible riots, they said, well, then let us get some cut of the taxpayer money to form our own schools. And, like, you know, we won't have all this friction in these schools that are openly hostile to us and intentionally hostile to us, because it was a sort of nativist driving thing against the Irish immigrants. That erupted in violence. So it stemmed from an early plea in New York. Dagger John Phelps was sort of run out of town when he sought equal, fair funding of Catholic schools. So it was those who wanted to not fund private religious education that responded to the request with violence. Now, I'm not suggesting at all that that's what's happening today, but the idea that violence follows from equal funding, I think, actually gets the historical story backwards.
May I respond?
Go ahead, Rachel. This is what we're here for, I suppose.
Okay, yeah, here we go. The Bible riots were caused by the unfortunate reality that there was a preference for one religion over others in public schools. That is actually what caused the riots, right? And the idea that religious minorities, you know, and Baptists have in their theology a commitment to church-state separation because they remember when they were treated poorly and were the religious minorities in America. But the idea that religious minorities could be equally served in a government system that sort of opens itself up is flawed for so many reasons. I don't even know where to begin, but let me start by saying the bias that we just referenced, right, that would come into play. Let me also give an example from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency press of a Florida charter school operator, a Jewish one, who claimed, oh no, this is good though, you know, because we can fund our Jewish yeshivas as well. And he took a visit to Oklahoma and immediately was quoted as saying, oh no, forget it, like scratch that, there aren't enough of us here for that to happen. So it's unrealistic. It's a constitutional violation, and America would do best to stay committed to its promise of church-state separation in the realm of public education and education that's supported by the government, to cut down on division, to protect taxpayers' religious freedom, and to protect religion itself.
We maybe have time for one more question. We've covered a lot of terrain. We've covered the background of this case. We talked about some of the finer details about public-private entities that will be the next phase of this litigation, or the next phase of this issue, litigated or not. And we've also talked a bit about, obviously, some of the larger underlying concerns that both John and Rachel have in mind here. Here's a question, though, that is, I thought, kind of an interesting new one since the case was decided, quote unquote, or not decided. The audience member asked, since the core of this topic seems to be about whether charters are governmental and the distinction would not apply just to religious entities that want to have a charter, but all charters, how would the Maryland case decided this term to allow parents to opt out on religious grounds apply to charter schools, or would all charters as private actors be able to religiously discriminate? So an interesting question there about in this next turn of these issues about school funding and religious education and parents, how does Mahmoud versus Taylor affect any of these issues in your view, John?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is an important point to end on. Maybe you know, all of the concerns that Rachel's articulated, or that you'll see about this case, they only manifest about if we're wrong. If I'm wrong that a charter school in Oklahoma or whatever other state, if I'm wrong and it really is the government, then we agree, right? Then it can't be Catholic. It can't do it. So all these concerns about what the government's going to do to our children, they only manifest if I'm wrong that it's not the government, right? So to bring that into the Mahmoudi. So if charter schools are governmental, then they're state actors and the constitutional restraints apply to them, and et cetera. So suddenly I think Mahmoud becomes relevant. I would say the particular question in Mahmoud about opting out and the coercion about if you offer this public school option and there is no other opt out and what's a kid or a parent who wants to raise their kid in a different way with respect to their religion, what do they do about that? They need an ability to opt out. For a charter school, I might be wrong, but I think all, if not all, or nearly all across the country, charter schools are opt-in models. So even though it would be state action, if they are the government, the opt-in, opt-out question becomes very different because you showed up there in the first place and you presumably chose it over a different option. So I'm not really sure it shakes out the same. Of course, if charter schools, if I'm right, and charter schools in many of these states are not governmental, well, then it's just like choosing any other privately run school, right? They design their curriculum as they design it.
Yeah. Rachel, any thoughts about that issue?
Yeah, I mean, just that, lots of thoughts. I mean, firstly, we disagreed with the Mahmoud decision on whole. We think public schools should teach our kids how to coexist across their differences, much like we're doing today, and to respect everyone. And in that regard, they're a glue for our pluralistic democracy, and parents are always free to impart separately their moral and religious values at home and through religious education. But also, imagine how unworkable Mahmoud would make religious charter schools, because we just had this conversation earlier about how they have to be open to all, right? And John, you were celebrating families who aren't Catholic who've gone, right? But when Mahmoud comes into play, then the religious charter school would have to provide an opt-out for families, for parents, from all religious instruction, okay, to which the parents object, right? The free exercise clause would require it. And so now take a school like St. Isidore, which integrates religious instruction into all of its secular subjects very intentionally, having to offer those opt-outs, it's just unworkable.
Yeah, and to be clear, if the school is Catholic, it is therefore, in the St. Isidore, if it's allowed to exist, it's because it's private. And so therefore you can't sue it in the same way you could sue the government. And it's an opt-in model. So I think for two different reasons, even if it were the government, but especially if it's not the government, I think the claims made in Mahmoud look very different for a school you opt into, especially if it's privately run. So.
Well, we are past 1 hour, and I am grateful for this civil and robust discussion between John Meeser and Rachel Lazar about what the next issues will be in the discussion about religious charter schools following the Supreme Court's non-decision in the Drummond case. And we will stay tuned to see what the next issues might be, and we'll be back, we hope, with another webinar when ready. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Rachel.
Bye, everyone. Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.